The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution. When they do diminish, when they're brought down by oppression, trouble, and grief, God pours contempt on their leaders, making them wander aimlessly in the wastelands. But God raises the needy from their suffering. God makes their families as numerous as the sheep. This is the word in black and red. Hello, and welcome to The Word in Black and Red, where we read the Bible from a leftist and liberationist perspective to elucidate the way people of faith and their comrades can understand the Bible as a source of healing, love, and liberation for all people. I'm your host, Michael Belong, the wise old Lama MB, joined today once again by the wonderful Avery from Blessed Are the Binary Breakers, and new friends, Brandon and Brandon from the Found in Translation podcast, a podcast that I have absolutely adored getting into as Brandon the Translator, as we'll refer to him here tonight, translates through the scriptures and seeks to eliminate a lot of the religious language and baggage that that is carried with that. And that's a conversation that we'll end up having on salvation and liberation later on, which I'm very excited for. Brandon the Translator is joined by his wonderful co-host, Brandon Rhodes. And Brandon just bring the scripture to life in all of these wonderful ways. And so I'm just so excited that they reached out to be a part of this podcast. And I'm so excited for the conversation that we're about to have. So Brandon Rhodes, would you mind telling us a little bit about your political tendency, religious background, and how we can connect with you?
Yeah. Let's see. Political tendency would be I've checked most boxes of leftist off over the years. I got an affinity for a few different flavors of anarchism and socialism. On the on my intake for the Discord, I think I put aspirational solar punk socialist. But really, I try to describe what I am drawn towards and what I desire and speak to what I am, I suppose, raging against more than using ism words. So I rage against, I suppose, authoritarianism, domination, and just the gross, stupid hierarchies that we try to turn every distinction and difference into. I am more drawn towards the beloved community of that is sustainable and spacious and queer and creative and abundant and mutual. My religious background, let's see. I grew up in the evangelical world at a kind of a mega church, and then eventually found my way into intentional communities in college. That was a pretty revelatory experience for me. I was taking ecology courses and seeing how everything was connected to each other, and then like seeing in real life how much our faith is connected to one another. And that really transformed and informed my faith going forward. So over the years, since I've found a real affinity for liturgy and trauma-informed ways of doing the faith. And I suppose nowadays I would describe myself as an Episcopalian on Sunday and an Anabaptist on Monday. I also find a lot of good energy in contemplative and mystical streams.
Yeah, political tendencies, I don't know about labels in specific either, but I kind of tend to think in terms of being for people, wanting people to have what they need, having encouraging a culture of taking care of each other. And sometimes that means stepping up against things that hurt people, like racism and homophobia and transphobia and all the things that hurt people systemically. So justice oriented, I guess, would be maybe a way to put it. Religiously, grew up evangelical, went to a Pentecostal college, worked at a Presbyterian church, had mystical experiences with the Catholics, and now in a neighborhood-based intentional community / house church, where we're doing a lot of sharing life together and trying to, on a really small scale, put some of those justice and caring for each other and our neighbors into practice.
Again, you can connect with Avery at Blessed Are the Binary Breakers. Avery, what are you up to these days with Blessed Are the Binary Breakers?
Hello. That is a great question, Micah. As we are entering 2024, I'm sort of starting to ask myself that question as well of where I want to take the podcast this year. I don't have any interviews lined up at the moment, so it's sort of, I'll definitely have an episode out this at the end of this month where I'll probably talk about where I'm hoping to head. This year, I'm going to be focusing a lot more on sort of being active offline, if that makes sense, like in a community around here, around Atlanta, sort of networking, doing in-person workshops and stuff. So I'm not really sure where I'm headed right now, but hopefully somewhere exciting.
We have had a wonderful time getting to know each other a little bit. One of the things that I really love about Found in Translation is just this little moment where the Brandons share what they're drinking. And I've recently learned that they actually now record in the mornings, which makes the drinking a little bit more suspicious than it was at first. But I'm enjoying a Balvenie 14-year cask that I put just a little bit too much water into for what I normally like. But it's still spicy. Spicy as fuck. So dear listener, if I have any particularly egregious takes, blame it on the scotch. And we'll go ahead and jump on into the text. Genesis 43 through 44. The famine was severe in the land, and when the family had eaten all the grain that the brothers had brought back from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little food." Judah said to him, "The man was absolutely serious when he said, 'You may not see me again without your brother with you. If you agree to send our brother with us, then we will go down and buy you food. But if you don't agree to send him, then we can't go down because the man said to us, "You may not see me again without your brother with you."' Israel said, "Why have you caused me such pain by telling the man that you had another brother?" They said, "The man asked us pointedly about our family. Is your father still alive? Do you have a brother?" So we told him just what we've said. How were we to know, he'd say, "Bring your brother down here." Judah said to his father Israel, "Send the young man with me. Let's get ready to leave so that we can stay alive and not die, we, you, and our children. We will guarantee his safety. You can hold me responsible. If I don't bring him back to you and place him here in front of you, it will be my fault forever. If we hadn't waited so long, we would have returned twice by now." Their father Israel said to them, "If it has to be, then do this. Take in your bag some of the land's choice produce and bring it down to the man as a gift, a little medicinal resin, a little honey, gum, resin, pistachios, and almonds. Take twice as much silver with you and take back the silver returned in the top of your sacks. It might have been a mistake. And take your brother, get ready, and go back to the man. May God Almighty make the man compassionate toward you so that he may send back your other brother and Benjamin with you. But me, if I'm left childless, then I'm left childless." So the men took this gift. They took twice as much silver with them together with Benjamin. They left, traveled down to Egypt, and received an audience with Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the manager of his household, "Bring the men to the house and slaughter an animal and prepare it, because the men will have dinner with me at noon." The man did as Joseph told him, and brought the men to Joseph's house. When they were brought to Joseph's house, the men were frightened and said, "We've been brought here because of the silver put back in our sacks on our first trip, so he can overpower us, capture us, make slaves of us, and take our donkeys." They approached the man who was Joseph's household manager and spoke to him at the house's entrance. "Please, master, we came down the first time just to buy food. But when we stopped to spend the night and opened our sacks, there was the exact amount of each man's silver at the top of his sack. We've brought it back with us. And we've brought down with us additional silver to buy food. We don't know who put our silver in our sacks." He said, "You are fine. Don't be afraid. Your God and your father's God must have hidden a treasure in your sacks. I received your money." Then he brought Simeon out to them. The manager brought the men to Joseph's house and gave them water to wash their feet and feed their donkeys. They prepared the gift, anticipating Joseph's arrival at noon, since they had heard that they would have a meal there. When Joseph came into the house, they presented him the gift they had brought with them into the house, and they bowed low in front of him. He asked them how they were and said, "How is your elderly father, about whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" They said, "Your servant, our father, is fine. He's still alive." and they bowed down again with deep respect. Joseph looked up and saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, and he said, "Is this your youngest brother whom you told me about? God be gracious to you, my son." Joseph's feelings for his brothers were so strong, he was about to weep. So he rushed to another room and wept there. He washed his face, came back, pulled himself together, and said, "Set out the dinner." So they set out his food by himself, their food by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with them by themselves, because Egyptians don't allow themselves to eat with Hebrews. The Egyptians think it beneath their dignity. They were seated in front of him from the oldest to the youngest in their exact birth order. And the men looked at each other with amazement. Portions of food from Joseph's table were brought to them, but Benjamin's portion was 5 times as large as theirs. So they drank together and were at ease. Joseph gave commands to his household manager, "Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they'll hold, and put each man's silver at the top of his sack. Put my cup, the silver cup, on the top of the youngest brother's sack, together with the silver for his grain." So he did just as Joseph had told him to do. At dawn, the men and their donkeys were sent off. They had left the city, but hadn't gone far when Joseph said to his household manager, "Get ready, go after the men and catch up with them. Ask them, 'Why have you repaid hospitality with ingratitude? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and uses to discover God's plans? What you've done is despicable.'" When he caught up with them, he repeated these words. They replied, "Why does my master talk to us like this? Your servant would never do such a thing. The silver that we found at the top of our sacks, we've just brought back to you from the land of Canaan. We didn't steal silver or gold from your master's house. Whoever of your servants is found with it will be put to death and will be my master's slaves." He said, "Fine, we'll do just as you've said. Whoever is found with it will be my slave, and the rest of you will go free." Everyone quickly lowered their sacks down to the ground, and each opened his sack. He searched the oldest first and the youngest last, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. At this, they tore their clothing. Then everyone loaded their donkeys, and they returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers arrived at Joseph's house, he was still there, and they fell to the ground in front of him. Joseph said to them, "What's this you've done? Didn't you know someone like me can discover God's plan?" Judah replied, "What can we say to my master? What words can we use? How can we prove we are innocent? God has found your servants guilty. We are now your slaves, all of us, including the one found with the cup." Joseph said, "I'd never do such a thing. Only the man found with the cup will be my slave. As to the rest of you, you are free to go back to your father." Judah approached him and said, "Please, my master, allow your servant to say something to my master without getting angry with your servant, since you are like Pharaoh himself. My master asked his servants, 'Do you have a father or brother?' And we said to my master, 'Yes, we have an elderly father and a young brother, born when he was old. His brother is dead, and he his mother's only child. But his father loves him. You told your servants, "Bring him down to me so I can see him." And when we said to my master, 'The young man can't leave his father. If he leaves, his father will die.' You said to your servants, 'If your youngest brother doesn't come down with you, you'll never see my face again.' When we went back to my father, your servant, we told him what you said. Our father told us, 'Go back and buy for us a little food.' But we said, 'We can't go down. We will go down only if our youngest brother is with us. We won't be able to gain an audience with the man without our youngest brother with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife gave birth to 2 sons for me. One disappeared, and I said, "He must have been torn up by a wild animal," and I haven't seen him since. And if you take this one from me too, something terrible will happen to him, and you will send me, old as I am, to my grave in despair. When I now go back to your servant, my father, without the young man, whose life is so bound up with his, and when he sees that the young man isn't with us, he will die, and your servants will have sent our father, your servant, old as he is, to his grave in grief. I, your servant, guaranteed the young man's safety to my father, telling him, if I don't bring him back to you, it will be my fault forever. Now please, let your servant stay with your slave instead of the young man, so that he can go back with his brothers. How can I go back to my father without the young man? I couldn't bear to see how badly my father would be hurt." Sorry, I was getting a little emotional as we go through that passage here that, you know, Judah, he just, he knows that he's fucked up. Like he seems to really get it for the first time in his life. And here he is just pouring out his heart to Joseph in this really emotional way that he doesn't want to do this kind of betrayal to his father again. He's already done it once and he carries that guilt with him and he doesn't want to do it again.
Yeah, I really have noticed this section. It's just like the story of Judah's transformation is pretty central to these few stretches of chapters in this part of Genesis. I remember growing up thinking that like Joseph was the good guy in these stories. And the more I go back and read it, I'm like, he's gaslighting them. He's messing with them. Like, I don't know that Joseph is the one we want to emulate here. But Judah, like what you're saying, he's done some self-reflection since he sold Joseph into slavery a few chapters back. He's really turned around.
Well, and you know, in this way, well, first off, you're absolutely right? That Judah was the person standing with power at the beginning of this story. He uses that power. He abuses his younger brother. He gets his younger brother what he thinks is killed, or at least sold off into slavery, never to be heard from again. And then comes to a new position where he is without power, and that's the only way that he's able to ask for forgiveness and begin this arc of redemption, where he is powerless in the situation except to offer his own life in exchange. And Joseph, in the opposite trajectory, goes from being, well, you know, a little bit of a dick, at least, a cocky teenager at most, right, to being this powerful person who can gaslight his brothers, who can, you know, who can do all these sort of manipulation tactics and all these sort of things that don't seem like a very healthy relationship here, because he has power that Judah has given up.
And yet he doesn't use that power to help his brothers. Like, he has these dreams. He's at the pit of, you know, he's at the bottom of his life, you know, basically having to help the neighboring empire out, and gets these dreams to barely keep himself going. He has these things of like, there's going to be some shit going down. It's going to last quite a while. And so he goes from, you know, prison to the top, rags to riches and all that, from the same God. He keeps referring to El, but he doesn't like tip off his family. Like, there is such a like loss of identity and disassociation he has undergone along the way. He is no longer his brother's keeper here, or his father's. He doesn't even like, fuck his brothers. They tried to kill him. I kind of get that sense of like, I'm okay, I'm done with them. But even his old dad, he's not telling him this thing's coming. Yeah.
I totally see where y'all are coming from. And I'm also, throughout our talk, I'm going to expose myself as like, I'm a huge Joseph fan to the point where it's hard for me to acknowledge the flaws. So I appreciate y'all bringing out like that Joseph does have mega flaws, like all humans. But you'll know, like, I'll be the one who's like, but Joseph's cool, actually. So sorry in advance. But like in that, for that part, I both agree with you. And I'm also like, if Joseph had tried to tell his family, tried to send a message to say, hey, a famine's coming, Why would Joseph have any reason to believe that they would believe him, when back as a teen, him trying to share his dreams with them led to this mega rejection, where they you know, contemplate murdering him and then end up selling him into slavery. He might just assume that they won't listen to his dreams because they didn't back then.
Yeah, it'd be a decent assumption.
And then in the next chapter, when he reveals himself, they're like, huh? Right, to doubt that they would even trust that it's him, even to his face.
As I was reflecting on this passage for this, thinking about trauma of all the things that Joseph went through, being almost murdered and then sold as property by his own family, and then all the abuse that he endured and being imprisoned and all the things over the, like, he's learned how to survive, as we all do through trauma. And so, yeah, some of the behaviors, like straight up gaslighting and threatening and that he's doing here, like, that's not okay. And there's part of me that does understand where that's coming from. He's trying to protect himself, even just from the feelings that are overwhelming from remembering everything.
That's how I feel about a lot of this too, is that just knowing how trauma works, most trauma is sort of founded in this inability to control your situation, which is where Joseph used to be. And so now that Joseph is the one in control, I tend to read this story as a model for how we might consider what is required for true forgiveness and reconciliation to take place. The problem with this model is that in this story, Joseph has like so much more power than his brothers do now, that when I want to talk about how in order for true forgiveness and reconciliation to take place, the person who was wronged and didn't have power needs to now be the one with the power in a situation. It's kind of yes, but maybe not as much power as Joseph is able to wield over them, because maybe that's a little too much. Maybe removing power from the equation, being able to have them on equal footing, would be a little more ideal. But I do think that it's important for Joseph to feel, whether or not it's ethical or not, I think for Joseph, he feels a need to feel in control over his brothers. And that means that he's going to play these sort of tricks that are causing them a lot of distress and a lot of fear, and is bringing Benjamin and Jacob into it, like causing them distress and fear when they are not the wrongdoers. So it's sort of bringing in this collateral damage, hurting people that didn't wrong Joseph. But Joseph feels like he needs to make sure that the brothers who wronged him have actually changed. He hasn't seen any, you know, like they've been out of his life. He doesn't know what's been happening in the interim, whether they've changed their ways. And so I think part of why he brings Benjamin into it is he wants to see if they'll sell out Benjamin the way they sold out him.
Why did they do this to me? Is it because my mom is Rachel? Maybe they'll do it to him too. Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, will they do it to Benjamin as the other half-brother?
I almost wonder if they assume that he will, or he assumes that they will, like not so much as a test of like, hey, maybe this is my chance to reclaim my brother, get him under my protective custody without them ever suspecting who I am. They'll even just think I imprisoned their brother, and it may not have actually been intended as a test so much until they suddenly passed the test that he didn't know he was presenting to them, and turn things around.
Oh, that's a good point, that no matter how they respond, it's in Joseph's favor, because if they are willing to hand Benjamin over, well, now he has Benjamin. That's a good point.
I like the idea that he's trying to protect Benjamin, but I think that so often, like, even our thoughts of how I can protect this other person are actually how I can protect myself, right? The ways that, like, trying to protect Benjamin, yeah, that might be the story he tells to the rest of the world, but really he's trying desperately to hold on to the only person he knows who hasn't betrayed him, right? Like, he knows that the Pharaoh will drop him at the drop of a hat, right? He knows that the Pharaoh is a fickle guy who, if he has to concern himself with much more than what wine he picks out, he's going to be pissed off, right? And he knows that the same thing happened when he was in Potiphar's household, right? That it just took an accusation for him to get kicked out, right? He knows that it happened in prison where it was one person's good word, but they forgot to share that good word for a long time. He knows that that happened in his own family, right? And the only person he really knows has never betrayed him. Maybe he doesn't even know that his father hasn't betrayed him. Maybe he's sitting here thinking for decades, my dad gave me the princess dress, and that princess dress is why I got sold into slavery in the first place, right? My dad screwed me over as much as everybody else did in my life. And, you know, the only person who he doesn't know has hurt him in any way is Benjamin, who was probably just a kid when he disappeared and didn't have the time to hurt him. And so this is the one connection in the world he knows is safe and is desperate to cling on to that tiny bit of safety.
He wasn't giving Benjamin a say in this. There was no consent to, like, completely upending Benjamin's whole life. Like, so even if he could, you know, we're speculating somewhat, but even if he could have persuaded himself, like, I'm doing this for Benjamin, like, would Benjamin have said the same thing?
That creates almost this, like, chiastic tragedy to it, where, like, the first tragedy is for Israel is losing Joseph. And then to protect his brother, he's going to take Israel and Rachel's other brother from it. It's like he's recapitulating while thinking he's being the savior. It's so sad.
Well, and another chiasm that I'm seeing here is the way that the other character who's described as running away and weeping, Isaac, right? Joseph here is replicating so much of what Isaac is doing in a strange sort of mirror where Isaac weeps over the loss of his mother, Sarah, and then he's only really solved of that when Rebecca shows up and he clings to Rebecca so fiercely at first, but then they seem to have some sort of divide in the relationship, maybe because he's trying to replace his mom with his wife and they end up having kids where they take opposite sides in who should be the heir, and with Isaac favoring Esau and Rebecca favoring Jacob, and now in this grandson, that the opposite side of Jacob's life, where Joseph weeping and trying to cling to the one form of safety he has in this emotionally terrible moment, is also going to tear apart Jacob's life in this really dramatic way.
The phrase that keeps jumping to mind, probably overused now, but that hurt people, like, is the entire story of Genesis, is these figures who are horrifically traumatized by family members, and then in their grappling for any sort of sense of security for themselves, end up assimilating into the power structure, perpetuating the power structure, and traumatizing their family members, and starting the cycle, like, keeping the cycle going just over and over. And I feel like Joseph is so close to breaking it. Like, oh, I want Joseph to break it, but I don't know that it, I don't believe it happens.
I don't think it does. And I'm only going to disappoint you, Avery, when my episodes come out about how badly I think he does. I just want to add that I think that it's not just the story of the Bible. I think the Bible tells the hurt people story so well, time and time again, right? Where we cling, in particular in the book of Genesis, that people cling to wealth, and that as a form of protection causes them to hurt other people and divide families and divide, you know, and separate people out. But I think that story is the story of humanity, right? I don't think it's just the story of the Bible. We read the Bible, and this podcast exists as a study of the Bible because this is a universal story, and the Bible remains the most sold and read book in the history of the world, not because I think Christianity is, you know, the most dominant religion or anything like that. I think it's because this story just continues to ring true, and the Bible tells it so well.
We're riffing on parallelisms. What comes to me is that Cain and Abel, you know, it's brothers murdering brothers and hurting each other and picking out their difficult emotions on each other. And the question of, am I my brother's keeper? I think the answer was supposed to be yes. And over and over again, we see people not doing that with Jacob and Esau and Joseph and the other brothers that betrayed him. And then here we finally have Judah taking care of Benjamin, giving himself up for his brother.
Something that I always try to remind myself when looking at these chapters, I think the previous chapters that I wasn't part of a conversation for, but I assume, Micah, they've already been recorded and happened, the start of the story with the reconciliation with the brothers, is that it takes place over such a large span of time, like from Joseph being sold by his brothers to when he meets them again. Just that neither side in the equation knows how much the other side has grown and changed. The way we get to read through the chapters, we see right after Judah sells Joseph into slavery, like, isn't it the next chapter that Judah refuses at first to take responsibility with what he does with Tamar, and then she compels him to, and he's like, shit, you're right. You are actually, like, super righteous. You're awesome. Sorry about that. So, like, we get to see his growth. Joseph has no clue about any of that going on. So, again, for me, it makes sense that the second, like, Joseph has been grappling his way towards a sense of security for these many, many years. And in Egypt, he's been able to find that through gaining power in Pharaoh, you know, in Pharaoh's household and amassing wealth, at which, like you mentioned, Micah, is super, it's still precarious because it can be taken on a whim, you know, it's what he has. He's, I don't know if it's been mentioned in previous episodes, but when he names his kids, he names them Ephraim and Manasseh, are names that basically mean like, I'm leaving the past behind me. It's forgotten. I'm letting it go. He's, you know, found this foothold. He's in a secure place. And then his brothers come back and send it all toppling again. And he's so emotional and he has to leave the room to go cry over and over. I don't know. It just, it makes me feel for him a lot because, and I think it's because I can't help but bring my like queer perspective into it. And like, when you think, and like, again, with trauma, you think you finally got it behind you and then something happens in your life that sends you toppling again. Like,
oh yeah. Over and over.
Yeah. Like these toxic habits come back out and suddenly he's like tricking his brother, like, you know, saying like, you stole this from me. And it's like, well, no, they didn't. Maybe you're talking about in the past how they betrayed you. And so you're creating these new, you know, pretending that they stole from you when you know they didn't. So that you can be mad at them. I don't know. It's so messy.
Yeah, super messy, as life is.
I love the fact that it's Judah, right? It is Judah who is the main character here, who's going through this transformation. And I love that, as you were talking, Avery, the fact that like Joseph doesn't know the transformation that he's gone through, but Judah's story is the story of the Jewish people for the rest of the Bible, right? It's like it's the cycle of exactly as you described it, right? Of like thinking that they're all good and being all good and then fucking up and falling off the bandwagon and starting and getting greedy and not taking care of the poor and not taking care of immigrants and worshiping all these false idols of money and wealth and all those sort of things and having to restart the cycle and falling off, having no power because somebody came in and conquered them, and only then resetting and being able to go back and get back on the right track. It is just the continuous story of the Jewish people, and it is the continuous story of the church, right? Part of the reason that I'm Protestant is that I have to acknowledge that the church is fucked up pretty much constantly since the beginning, that this is the story of humanity, right? That we are just constantly in this state of being good, thinking we're over our trauma, fucking up, causing more pain to somebody else, and needing to restart that cycle again. It's almost like we celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus every year for a reason, because we keep needing it.
Yeah, it's a reminder every time.
I want to bring up two little notes that I really like in the text and get y'all's thoughts on them. First off, the seeing cup. This is just a fascinating little bit of the text that that I love here, right? We know through the story so far that Joseph is a dream fortune teller, right? He hears the dream, he can tell you what it means. And in the ancient magic of this area, that was a respected position, that he is able to attain all of this glory and whatnot because he has this magical ability, right? And throughout the Bible, there are various different little magical items that are played with in interesting ways. If you're a Retelling the Bible podcast fan, which I hope all of you are, Scott there, our buddy Scott, goes into, in one of his episodes, on the prophet going up and cursing the altar at Bethel. It is the prophet there is playing with the Urim and the Thurim, right? These little magical dice kind of things that cast lots and we're able to tell the future because of it, right? And so here is just another one of those little seeing cups. I'd love y'all's insight and thoughts on the seeing cup as it plays a part in this story, a strange little part that was certainly not on any of the felt cardboard Sunday school lessons that I ever saw as a kid.
First of all, for me, like, having grown up and knowing my wife too, like growing up and learning that like fortune telling and stuff is like demonic and stuff, to have a biblical figure who is, you know, one of the like protagonists of the story use something like that is always just fun to see. It also makes me want to, if anyone knows, like just to dive in, like, where did Joseph get this cup? Is it something that Joseph would have brought from his own culture, or is this an Egyptian thing? And evidence of how Joseph has sort of, to an extent, assimilated or at least like syncretized his own behaviors into the Egyptian culture, where Joseph is still worshiping El, the god of, you know, his family. And yet, is this cup part of more Egyptian religion, so that this fun like syncretism of the faiths? I don't know if anyone has thoughts, but that's how I like to see it.
Syncretism is often a slur, but yeah, I would put it somewhere on that spectrum of like, he's been cut off from the family practice of worshiping El. And you, when he's doing the dream telling, we don't really have any window into what that is or what that looks like. There may well be sacred paraphernalia as part of that. But by the time he's ascended, fast forward, he's figured out how to code switch pretty well. And he's also figured out how to bring some trinkets into the work of divine access. And to me, there's a layer to this story of it's a refugee tale of how do you find fidelity to your roots, where you're able, and where do you need to break them apart? How do you just get by in this culture? So as a refugee, it's, and looking at the story through that lens, like of trauma, cross-culture, cross-religious, to me, it's just a fun little side detail of like how he's changed a bit. It also makes him almost a bit more of a warlock. Like he's now he's a priest king. He's Melchizedek. I love that that and the Urim and Thummim, there's these odd little details of a more henotheistic, adaptive, way less tidy way of being faithful to the one who called Abraham. The slop in Genesis compared to what my evangelical seminary professors were allowed me to see in there is just such a fun playground.
So the little that I've been able to figure out from my research is that there was a practice of divination cups in the cult of Anubis in ancient Egypt. But it's not, I don't have a lot more information on it than that. Unfortunately, what I do have is the cup of Ankh in D&D, which I think is actually a reference to Discworld, where the main city is Ankh-Morpork. And so I think it's the cup of Ankh referencing Discworld. I want to eventually teach a class on the fact that Terry Pratchett's Small Gods is the perfect encapsulation of postmodern thoughts on religion. Anyway, if anybody knows what that is, we should definitely talk about it sometime. Small Gods and Hogfather, I think, are the best explanations of postmodern views of religion that really stand up. And when I eventually write my book on how to be a Christian atheist, it will include a lot of references to that. And for anyone listening, I am a theist. I always have to throw that out. I just want to make room for our Christian atheist comrades and siblings of the faith. So you don't have to believe in God to belong to God. So anyway, so the seeing cup as this sort of symbol of another religion. I love that, the syncretism, the fact that like, first off, like Judaism or ancient Israelite religion is a syncretistic religion, right? We have these different names of gods that are coming together to become the one God. El and Yahweh were originally different gods that come to be known in the Exodus story as one God, right? Or at least according to the mythos of the Torah, as one God, right? And Asherah being in there as well. But I love the fact that there is this other name for God that was probably an independent deity, El Shaddai, right? That again is morphed into, Shaddai was probably an independent deity, and El being the god of at least part of the Israelites, right? That becomes morphed into the god that we understand and we know and we worship. And El Shaddai is again brought up. Every time that we have seen El Shaddai so far in the book of Genesis, it has been, again, a reference to fertility. And here we don't see any different. In verse 14, may God Almighty, El Shaddai, the many-breasted God, make the man compassionate toward you so that he may send you back your other brother and Benjamin with you. But me, if I'm left childless, then I'm left childless. Right? It is again this invocation of El Shaddai, the many-breasted God, in this moment of a question of whether or not he's going to have children. Right? And you know what it strikes me again here in this passage is, what do you mean you're childless? You have 10 other sons and at least one other daughter. Like, what the fuck are you on about, man?
Unless he's that worried that this strange person in Egypt is going to like kill all his or imprison all his children. Otherwise, you're right. Like, how are they hearing him say this about like, just losing one?
What are we, chop liver? Yeah.
Yeah. Jacob, you need to get over your favoritism. It's part of what caused all this mess in the first place.
Absolutely. And he never does. Like, he dies without ever repenting of this, right? And it's so strange to me because he was the victim of his father's favoritism for his brother, right? Why would he do this to his own kids as well?
And then Joseph recapitulates the favoritism game in singling out to save Benjamin.
I guess it's the problem of when you don't have a model for something different, you can't imagine something different. So you end up just doing the same thing over and over, which is sad.
Yeah. The translator had a good angle on this verse. I really want to hear it.
Yeah, the word that's paired with El Shaddai there, that's translated either as compassion or mercy, depending on the translations, is the Rasamim, and it literally means womb. And so I've seen others like Dr. Wilda Gaffney translate it as womb love or mother love. It's getting in that sense of nurture and care.
I absolutely love that translation here. May God the many-breasted make the man have mother love towards you, right? That and the idea that compassionate love is like the love of a mother, right? That loves regardless of what you've done. And not all of us have experienced that kind of mother love. But I think that for those of us who have, like, that is an incredibly powerful emotion. The idea that you're going to be loved no matter what, you know, and now that father love can't be that thing, but historically through most of my culture's existence anyway, father love has been pretty far away from changing the diapers and getting puked on and being kept up all night, right? And mother love has endured all those things and still loved. And I love that vision here that may this man be transformed into a woman so that he can love you accordingly, right? Let's just trans the person we're talking about here.
One of the patriarchs recognizing that the only energy that will continue the line of promise or whatever is mama energy.
Jacob is this gender nonconforming figure who recognized the gender nonconformingness of his son Joseph. Maybe I should say his child Joseph, and celebrated that. And then this is a key part of his understanding of God and how you can deal with people who are being difficult, right? Is pray that he becomes not so manly. Pray that he becomes less like Esau and more like Rebecca, right?
I'm glad you brought up the gender nonconformity of both figures again, because that was something I noticed as you were reading this text, is how often the word man comes up. So I right, like the brothers keep saying this, there's this man in Egypt who keeps doing this to us. And so I was like, okay, is that actually, I like checked the Hebrew just to make sure. I'm like, oh yes, they are calling him Ish. They are saying man, man, man. And again, it's my own interpretation of Joseph, my soft spot for a trans Joseph makes it feel like, I'm just like, stop calling him that. But I mean, it's what they know, it's fair. But it just, again, you probably brought this up in a previous conversation of moving back, like the question of what does Joseph look like? Why don't they recognize Joseph? Is part of it that Joseph looks so Egyptian now? I mean, part of it's definitely that Joseph is pretending not to know Hebrew. Like in a previous chapter, it mentions that Joseph's talking to them through a translator and they see him as this powerful Egyptian man. And yet this powerful Egyptian man knows Hebrew, is their brother, and keeps having to go cry in a closet because he's so overwhelmed by emotion, which I love. The masking taking place, right? And this Joseph, spoilers, next episode is going to come out to them finally, but like in the meantime, just keeps having to run and cry alone, find that safe, secret place to be emotional, because at this moment, Joseph doesn't feel like he can be vulnerable and cry in front of them.
I was going to say the Hebrew language is limited in that it's only is masculine and feminine gender grammatically. There is no neuter, not just for people, but even for objects. So I might talk about, where did I leave my cup? And I would have to say, where did I put it? And it would be, where did I put him or put her? And so each is often translated as man, and it's the masculine version, and isha is the feminine version. But really, it means more like individual would be a just as valid way to translate that.
What I was kind of hoping is that if I checked the Hebrew, it would either be Adam or like there would just be no noun. You know, I was kind of hoping it would be an instance where the English is just putting a noun because it would fit in English better. But
there are a few occasions in the Bible where they definitely bend the note.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was my hope. But I also absolutely agree with you that just because they're calling Joseph Ish doesn't have to. Yeah. They're working with a limited, like English as well, right? Within the limitations of language.
Well, and in a couple of years when we finally get to cover the story of Jonah, right, we'll visit the gender-bending fish that swallowed him. And, you know, and the fact that, like, it changes from a male to a female fish at one point during the story, and then changes back to a male fish, so...
Jonah, like, transed this fish's gender.
They're coming here with their trans agenda to go preach to the Ninevites. And anyway, trying to teach them salvation through the liberation of their souls. I think that the other part of that is I just like to often as this comes up, I like to say that a table doesn't change its gender when it goes from Berlin to Madrid, right? Like the grammatical gender is not the same as the actual gender of a person, right? And so you can call a table male in German and then female in Spanish, and it doesn't actually change anything about the table. Again, the way that Joseph is being described in this story makes sense given the grammatical boundaries of its time. But even the rabbis who are writing in the Midrash and the Talmud are writing these stories and acknowledging that there's at least six different concepts of gender, and that Isaac doesn't necessarily fit into the most masculine one, and Joseph doesn't necessarily fit into the most masculine one, but fits somewhere else in this vast spectrum of gender that they realized at least 2,000 years before anybody was going by they, them, you know? The last thing that I really want to have a conversation on and really to end on is my favorite verse, probably my favorite verse in the book of Genesis, is verse 30 of 44:30, when Judah says, "When I now go back to your servant, my father, without the young man, whose life is so bound up with his." That phrase, "whose life is so bound up with his," is really at the core of what we are trying to do as leftists, right? We are seeking to build communities where our lives are so bound up with one another that even though I'm going through trauma, that I don't have enough power over you to cause that hurt to hurt you as well, right? That's the goal as anarchists, right? Is that none of us have this power that Judah and Joseph have exchanged and switched roles in and suddenly become the opposite side of, if we just eliminated the power from the equation, we could just have our lives so bound up with each other that we wouldn't use and abuse one another, right? And if we had our lives so wound up in the well-being of the refugees that are beside us, then we wouldn't have a chance to be hurting them, right? Our lives would be so bound up with them that we would love them and we would take care of them and we would give back the silver that they try to pay us to provide them with the things they need to live. And instead, we would be bound up and our relationships would be what matters. And that's why I love intentional community, right? Is that you are choosing to have these people who, you know, might not be your best friends. they might not be the angelic beings that we'd hope one another be, right? But when you have your lives bound up with one another, you have to care about each other. You have to love each other in this way that breaks down so many of the power barriers and so many of the problems that keep us from the kind of world we want to live in.
That's beautiful. And It's also like you saying, that's the such a one of the main goals of everything we're working towards. It's almost like is to bind ourselves together like that. It's also to realize we already are bound together like that. Like even when we pretend we aren't, that our lives are already so tied up, not just human lives, but all creation.
Yeah, the divisions are illusions that we use to feel more secure.
Also, this is probably Brandon the translator's place to shine more than mine, but I just went and wanted to glance at what that Hebrew word for bind is there and to see where else it's used. And so this is just really quick, but it's kashar, and a couple other places it's used, this idea of binding, is in Deuteronomy, in places where it talks about binding, when it talks about binding God's words to your soul, that idea of wearing them as a sign on your hand. There's a couple places in Deuteronomy where it talks about that, and it uses that term of binding. And then another one that got me excited is it's in the books of Samuel, the idea that Jonathan and David's souls are bound together or knit together. It's that word. So I, you know, hopefully a different kind of binding, because I don't know about y'all, but I read that one as a little bit more romantic in nature. But just this idea that Jacob and Benjamin are so connected to each other, the way David and Jonathan are, that if something bad happens to one, it devastates the other, is really, really beautiful.
It all reminds me of that my daughter's second grade class. The teacher had a tradition of every morning they started the day off by reciting together a poem by Luis Valdez, In La Quiche. It says in Spanish first, and then in English it says, "You are my other me. If I do harm to you, I do harm to myself. If I love and respect you, I love and respect myself." I always loved that they did that.
I think as leftists, we often end up in these conversations about tactics and about all the politics that we need to be doing and the right way to organize and all of these other things. But I think that if we just stopped arguing about all of those things and instead just loved each other, I don't mean just loved each other in the "all you need is love" kind of sense. I don't mean a passive toleration of each other. I mean actually looking out for each other's well-being, which is a hell of a lot harder than organizing people to join a union, right? Not to say that that isn't valuable. That's incredibly valuable. And it is a way that we love each other, right? But it's harder. it is beyond just forming a protest, beyond joining a boycott, beyond all of the other things, beyond voting, beyond not voting, beyond all of the arguments that we might have on those fronts, beyond violence, beyond nonviolence. If we actually bothered to love each other, I think that a lot of these things, first off, would be a lot clearer about what we need to do next. But I also think that we would already have done the hard stuff, right? Because this relationship that happens here is not something that is easily recovered, right? Like, this happens because there is this tremendous strife that is going on here where Joseph, you know, he treats his brothers like shit. His whole family goes through this tremendous anguish. And then they come back together and they're just so relieved that they haven't dealt with the trauma for a while, right? And that plays out in a lot of ways that they end up interacting with each other. That ends up playing out in such a way that Joseph doesn't see the way that he continues to use power and abuse power that gets his family ultimately all to be enslaved, right? And then we have a story of Exodus that comes out because of the actions and the unhealed trauma that happens here in this story. Because just loving each other is a lot harder than we think it is, especially when we're trying to bind our lives together in this incredibly deep and powerful way.
I am so amazed at how much depth there is in this story, if I'm being honest. It's been 10 or 15 years since I've really seriously listened to the Joseph story. It took a lot of time for me to kind of slough off, kind of feeling it through the flannel graph memories of how I was, you know, raised with this story. And coming to it now through the voices of you all and just getting older and doing the work of like actually recognizing trauma in my own life, man, there is power in these behind the flannel graphs. So I'm super thankful for this opportunity to join this conversation and discover so much just vulnerable, raw humanity and deep insight in kind of a weird story.
I've been trying to really actively avoid saying, this is a weird story after every episode, after I get done reading on every episode, but it's true. Like this is a weird one. I think the thing that I'm taking away from this story again is that this is a story of it's just part of the Joseph story. It's the story of hurt people hurting people, right? And because this trauma is unrealized, because Joseph hasn't had time to sit down and think about his feelings, like he was in prison and then suddenly he was the most powerful person in Egypt apart from the Pharaoh, and in lots of ways more powerful than the Pharaoh, right? He didn't have time to process any of this. He didn't have time to sit down and think about how he was going to forgive his family or come to any sort of reconciliation before this.
Yeah. Or if he had time, I don't think therapists had been invented yet. As far as we know, he's the only person of his culture in his life, like, he doesn't have someone that he could probably trust to talk through it all with, so.
Therapy is hard enough. I can't imagine trying to do it in a second language.
And when you probably can't admit to much vulnerability because you're supposed to be this super powerful person.
Yeah. You don't have any peers, right? Like, everyone's underneath. Yeah.
Sorry, I just got the funny image of my mind of Joseph sitting down and sitting, laying down on a couch, and Pharaoh is in the corner with a notebook drawing hieroglyphics. And how did your tell me about your mother? but anyway, you know, this concept of hurt people hurting people, on the one hand, that we have to acknowledge that we are all hurt people. And we are all hurt people because we live under a system that hurts us, that causes us to hurt each other all the time. Under capitalism, we are taught to hate people because they are different from us, because they're a different gender than us, because they love different people than us, because they belong to a different culture or race or religion than us. And that is all reinforced by capitalism. And then we are forced to treat each other terribly because that's the only way that we can get an affordable iPhone or chocolate or any of the other things that make life under capitalism worth living. And then we see what happens when instead of allowing ourselves to be re-traumatized, we say, let us be bound up with one another. Let us be bound up in love for one another. And that changes everything. Well, Brandon and Avery, thank y'all so much for being a part of this podcast. I have so appreciated talking to y'all, and I look forward to the future episodes that we have. Avery, I'm not saying to invite me on your podcast, but I would love to be a guest if you're interested.
My God, come.
And then
join.
Okay, awesome. So, dear listener, if you are not already a fan of Blessed are the Binary Breakers or Found in Translation, please go and subscribe to both of those. I have just delighted in things from both of them. Blessed are the Binary Breakers helped me realize I was non-binary, and Found in Translation has saved me in several sermons already. And so I just so appreciate what y'all are doing all throughout the world and building a world that it's more like the one that I think God is calling us to do. And you, dear listener, I so appreciate the way that you're doing that as well. And the fact that you are sharing this in your communities, the fact that you are sharing and building mutual aid throughout the world, the fact that you're coming into our community with ideas for mutual aid and how we can, as an internet community, help each other and build connections. I've met in real life comrades that I am hoping to set up mutual aid with in our city because of this network. And so I so appreciate everything that y'all are doing. Please continue to be a part of it. Please continue to share it with your friends. Please give us a like and a review and all of those sort of things, because you are wonderful and we deserve to be bound up with one another in this meaningful way. Now, Past Micah, take it away.
Thank you, Future Micah. And of course, you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. Now go, and let us learn the ways in which we have been hurt, so that we do not hurt one another, but instead become so bound up with one another that our love builds the world we are called to enact. Shalom.